I'll try and be as quick as possible because I'd like to leave as much time as possible for questions. So we'll see how we go. I guess I started writing this paper 10 years ago, which explains the cryptic title because it's some further thoughts. The original thoughts I expressed 10 years ago at a similar convention in Darwin. And so that's really the starting point of this. I started writing this paper last year as an update on the 1999 paper, and then it sort of developed from there. So I should start off by acknowledging the input I've had from being part of this task force. Obviously, I take full responsibility for myself for what's in the paper, but I would like to thank all the various members of the task force, including Tom Karp over there, Tony Coleman particularly, our other treasure, and particularly some very good input from one or two people, several of the people in North America and Europe in particular. I think Nick Sherry's comment yesterday that our paper going to the G20 was sort of accepted by them, the indication of what he said, I think that's perhaps a little overstatement. I think it more likely got lost in the noise, but certainly it has achieved a fairly wide circulation amongst a number of places, particularly this joint forum, which is a fairly complicated organisation. But anyway, it has got very good reception wherever it's gone, and it's of course work's still going on in that area. So the agenda for today, first of all, I'll start with not what I said in 1999. I put that under the heading warnings. It's not so much because I want to say I told you so, but because I do want to say that the crisis could have been foreseen. There were plenty of signs out there between 1999 and 2007 that said, hey, things are getting out of control. And we'll go into that a bit more later. What caused the GFC? We've had four pretty heavy plenary presentations on that. I think at least one of the presenters is here. Thanks very much. So I'm not going to go into too much into that, but I will touch on it. The next item, are we there yet? Those of you who've gone on family driving holidays will be used to the whinge from the back of the car. Are we there yet? How much longer? The answer is I don't know, but I will touch on that point. The main purpose of the paper is prevention of future crises, and on that I'm fully backing the IAA task force report, which talks about a chief risk supervisor and the use of dynamic capital adequacy. So I'll go into that in some detail. But in the process of doing that, I've gone wandering off into the areas of control theory and systems theory, which I think can be quite helpful, and which I've seen very little written about in the context of the financial crisis. So I'll touch on that and as sort of fertile grounds for further investigation. Finally, as a bit of a throwaway, I've put in some stuff on product regulation, which has been a bit of a personal hobby horse, and sort of I managed to fit into this paper. So Darwin 1999, the main thoughts I had then were, first of all, I was worrying about the growth of what I called price-insensitive trades. That is, trades that are not driven by people seeking wealth maximisation, but trades that are done because people have to. They might be margin calls, they might be dynamic hedging transactions by life companies, it might be strategic asset allocation by super funds. Basically, they're not price-sensitive trades, and I just saw a growth in those trades, and my suggestion was that the more of those you got, the less likely you were to get efficient pricing in markets. I think people are putting these price-insensitive trades under the heading of bounded rationality rather than rationality, and it gets a bit difficult there. But anyway, it's something I was worrying about. I was particularly worried about the growth of leverage. I saw leverage appearing in all sorts of areas, and I was putting forward the view that leverage was the real enemy of market stability. A lot of the leverage was hidden in optionality of products, and I had some personal experience of such products, and so I spent a fair bit of time in 1999 looking at that, and particularly drawing attention to the dilemma that regulators would face when they were faced with a lot of institutions selling down their exposures in competition with each other, and the way that could lead to a market meltdown. So finally, I ended on rather a gloomy note that I thought unless people did something, took note of some of these issues, we could end up with a World Bank holiday. Well, we didn't quite end up with a World Bank holiday, but we got pretty close to it. So I sort of feel partly vindicated. Were the warnings appropriate? The optionality one was an interesting one, because I was looking at the amount of options that were being written on interest rate caps and collars and currency options and this sort of thing. What I didn't realise was fundamentally the whole housing mortgage market in the US was one giant put option, because it was a non-recourse mortgage. And a non-recourse mortgage is a straight mortgage plus a free put attached. And if you look at it that way, once the house market in the US started to go down, it just created an option payoff which couldn't be hedged. So I put a little letter in the Actuary magazine back late last year on that point. So that's already sort of in the literature. But I felt rather pleased when I suddenly discovered that optionality was something to worry about after all. A lot of what I was worrying about in 1999 now comes under the new buzzword pro-cyclicality, and that's been picked up by everybody, and we've seen plenty of mention of that over the last two or three days, so I don't need to see any more. Leverage, clearly there was a massive... The leverage I was worrying about in 1999 was minor compared with the leverage that was created after 9/11, if you like. So certainly it was right. I was right to worry about it. I was too early worrying about it. All of those did contribute to the global financial crisis, but I think it would be unfair to say that they were the cause. Everybody's got their idea of what was the cause, I don't propose to go over all those. In my paper, I do go into some detail as to what other people have said might have been the cause, but basically. It depends who you're listening to. Whoever expresses an opinion on the cause, it's usually someone else's fault. I've put up my own version and say, well, it's a matter of perspective. If you don't like the result of the game, first of all, who do you blame? Do you blame the players? In other words, oh, it's these greedy investment bankers. Secondly, you blame the referee. You say, oh, it was the regulators who were asleep at the wheel. Thirdly, then you say, well, really, it was the rules of the game that were wrong, so the politicians set up the regulations in the wrong fashion. Finally, you blame the crowd, because really it's all us voters who elected those politicians to let this party keep going, and so it's all our fault. Anyway, my preferred explanation is really that it was a classic case of systemic failure. The system, rather than being too big to fail, was too big to manage, and it basically sowed the seeds of its own destruction. Mark Lawrence yesterday put up this wonderful slide from McKinsey. I wish I had McKinsey to help me make slides. As a second best, I have a 12-year-old daughter, and this is her version, which is basically the same. I don't need to say any more. We saw the real one from Mark yesterday. So, how much longer? There are two people I want to refer to. First of all, Hyman Minsky. Some of you ought to know a bit about Hyman Minsky, because his name did appear in the investment course some years ago. So various people who've passed the investment subject ought to be vaguely aware of him. He was an economist who died about 10 years ago. Was sort of almost forgotten. He was writing stuff about leverage and about bubbles and crashes, and it became sort of conventional wisdom that markets were efficient and bubbles and crashes didn't exist except with hindsight, and therefore sort of Minsky got buried. But he's suddenly come back into his own now. He talked about three different kinds of debt. The first one was what he called hedged debt, which is debt that you can repay during its term out of you can pay off the principal and interest out of your cash flow. Nice and simple, like an old principal and interest mortgage. As long as you keep your job, that's hedged debt. The second sort is speculative debt, which is debt where you can afford to service it, but from time to time you need to roll it over. And that is speculative because you have to. It is a question of speculation as to whether you are able to roll over the debt at the end of the term. For instance, if your assets have fallen in value, you're not going to be able to roll it over. The third sort is Ponzi debt, which we're all familiar with. Ponzi debt, the traditional Ponzi scheme, is where you have to keep borrowing money just to pay the interest on the last lot of borrowings. As a boom develops, you get more and more, more and more debt becomes of the Ponzi variety. And you've only got to think of some of the products we were seeing back in 2005, 6, 7. Clearly that's what was happening. Anyone looking at systemic issues would have said, hey, this is going the wrong way. And what happens once you reach what's generally termed a Minsky moment, suddenly the whole thing turns around the Ponzi debt starts being called in. And at that point, assets start to fall in value and the speculative debt becomes Ponzi debt because you can't actually roll it over. And so you go into this deleveraging process. And that's really what we've been going through for the last, nearly 2 years now. And the issue really is how much longer is that going to go on? Ben Bernanke suggested a week or two ago, I think, that there were green shoots. I think it was Ben Bernanke who said the green shoots starting to appear. One of the green shoots, which I think which I saw literally overnight, a debt for equity swap. The lenders to Chrysler are proposing to swap $2.5 billion into equity. That's the sort of positive type of deleveraging that I think is very healthy. Other green shoots which people might look at, which are a rise in the copper price, I don't see as very healthy. That green shoot might be a weed. It's a very early stage. There's a lot of deleveraging still to go on. There's huge overhangs of assets which the lenders do not wish to keep financing. In Australia, I think there's $28 billion of commercial property which is on the block. And really no buyers. There's a few vulture funds around, a few sovereign wealth funds who would buy maybe at a price at some point in the future. But there's still $28 billion there that the banks are reluctant to finance. So from that point of view, it's still a way to go. The other person I always love quoting is Peter Bernstein. He's now 89 years old. A real guru, probably the greatest living treasure in the world, in the investment world. He wrote a very eloquent piece in the Financial Times just a few weeks ago, which sort of summed it up, and I've quoted that in my paper. But he's referring to the possible outcomes: are we going into deflation or hyperinflation? And the answer is we just don't know. What he does draw attention to is that you can't just use historic patterns, because they're historic results are only relevant to the point that the starting conditions were the same, and the starting conditions are just never the same. So the future is basically unknowable, is Peter's. At the age of 89, after 60-70 years in the investment markets, his conclusion is the future is unknowable. So I'm not going to contradict him. Now we get on to the core part of the paper, and I've probably spent a bit too long on the first half, but the IAA paper did focus on two things: what we called a chief risk supervisor. Other people are calling it a systemic risk supervisor, as I said, or whatever, call it what you like. Combined with a dynamic capital adequacy regime, I think it's dynamic capital adequacy. It's important to distinguish that from dynamic provisioning. The way I see it is that you have a regulator that actually takes an overnight decision as to change the capital requirements, and that comes as a surprise to the market, just the way the Reserve Bank changes interest rates, that comes as a surprise to the market. So that's the sort of regime I'm thinking of. I'm looking at a regulatory triumvirate, which consists of Treasury, that's worrying about fiscal policy and the level of economic activity, the central bank, which is looking at monetary policy and the level of inflation, and a third, equally important, systemic regulator, who's worrying about the capital ratios of the financial sector and the amount of leverage in the sector and various other systemic indicators. So I'm putting that systemic regulator up on a par with the other two. And part of the paper is just discussing where the role of that systemic regulator ought to be. There are people who suggest that's the role of the central bank. I would argue that there is a conflict of interest between managing inflation and managing systemic risk, and I prefer to see a different regulator. I see we've got John Trowbridge in the room. My preference is to take APRA, give it more independence, beef it up, put a new systemic risk department into it, and make APRA the systemic regulator. That's my personal preference. I understand John Lake is not particularly keen on that idea. It would be a tough job being a systemic regulator. You're the guy that when Chuck Prince and his friends are all dancing, you're the guy who's got to walk up to the jukebox and pull the plug out. It's not an easy job. So, but it's an important job. The central bank could do it. They're used to taking tough, independent decisions. But I just think that conflict of interest, and they're used to taking decisions on monetary policy, which are based upon expected inflation a year or two ahead. They're focusing on different issues. So that's one of the issues I'd like to discuss later. But in the meantime, what sort of things would... What should the systemic regulator be looking at that is not currently getting much attention? A couple of areas, one being control theory and the other being systems theory. Control theory really comes out of engineering literature. We've already stolen the actuarial control cycle out of the engineering literature, although some people would try and suggest we created it ourselves. The economists have taken a lot of control theory out of engineering literature, but I've seen very little mention of control theory in actuarial papers. I was talking to an engineering friend over a glass of wine, and we were talking, as you do, about the financial crisis, and I was explaining to him how I thought we needed some sort of mechanism which would sort of lean against systemic risk when it was rising and then relax when it goes down, and I was trying to explain the sort of factors, and he said, "What you're talking about is a PID controller." What's that? So anyway, went away and looked it up on Wikipedia. It's a very simple formula that's a basic part of process control. It's a three-factor formula. The easiest way is thinking of it in terms of inflation. If inflation is higher than you like, then the amount it's above where you want it to be is the proportionate bit. So that's the first term. The second term is you say how long has inflation been above where you want it to be, and you do an integral of it. So it's the cumulative effect of the higher inflation. So that's the integral term, and then how fast is inflation moving away from where you want it to be? That's the derivative term. So you just take those three measures, stick a constant on each one, and then you calibrate it and run it. That's a basic thing. There are lots of other control theory things, but since we actuaries are so much into control, I'm surprised we're not using more of these sorts of things already in our processes. So that's an area where I think there could be a fair bit of research, and that's the sort of thing that a systemic regulator, I think, would be using those sorts of tools to try and cool down various bits of the economy when they were getting out of hand. The other area is systems theory. Systems theory is a bit difficult because control theory is very much left brain stuff. On the other hand, system theory is very much right brain stuff. I originally discovered systems theory when I was reading The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy back in the 1970s, and then another book by Douglas Adams called Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency. How many people read that, I wonder? Yeah, a few. Yeah, okay, well, he talked about the fundamental interconnectedness of all things, and he was a bit ahead of his time because that's part of the cause of the GFC. We're trying to attribute cause and effect. We're trying to build time series, econometric models, etc. But really, on a systems basis, we're not looking at cause and effect. We're looking at influencing factors. We're looking at feedback. We're looking at thresholds, tipping points, recursion, which just means that it's a learning process where what happens today is a function of everything that's gone on before and has been learned into the system. So systems dynamics can be built in equations with feedbacks, etc. But even then, the point is it's changing all the time. It's learning. And so you have to be thinking quite differently. What in a closed system you're thinking of as being treated as an externality actually becomes internal to your system. Nothing is constant. So That's the real world. That's the real world. Organizational psychologists understand that, and they see the risk crisis as being a system failure rather than somebody causing the problem. There are some leading systems theorists in Europe who are actually working these are people who never had anything to do with finance. They're actually bringing systems theory to the financial crisis. I went to a conference recently in Rotterdam, which was mostly PhDs doing research stuff, and one of them from the Dutch Central Bank made a presentation on bank intervention in markets as a lender of last resort. His presentation was entirely based on game theory. No econometrics in it at all, purely game theory. So that's what we need to be looking at. I'll deal very quickly. In my paper, I produce a whole list of things that a systemic regulator might look at. Leverage ratios, particularly asset market levels. Targeting asset markets is something that's been a bit on the nose for economists for the last 20 years. Our Reserve Bank governor, Glenn Stevens, did mention in a speech a month or two ago that something that the Reserve Bank needs to revisit. But anyway, there's a whole lot of things. Financial innovation. I've added another one here. Particularly beware of new paradigm economists. Anything that smacks of a new paradigm, that's a signal that we're reaching the top of a bubble. Finally, my throwaway bit, and I realise I've gone as long as I intended to, so I'll be. But I say this didn't necessarily go into the paper, but it's something that I have felt strongly about personally for some time. There's been a lot of products around over the last few years which I think have added to systemic risk, and I've put some of the candidates up there. Products with embedded optionality, and that includes quite a number of life products, guaranteed annuity products, which are being sold like hotcakes around the world. Products containing leverage, obviously. Products with counterparty risks. Some of the structured products you see in the retail market, you think you're putting your money, well, it appears as if you're putting your money into a managed fund, but you're not. You're just entering into a total 100% counterparty position with an investment bank that is then using all sorts of weird and wonderful ways to actually replicate the exposure that they're promising to give you. It's not a managed fund at all. You've got no call on the underlying assets. All you've got is a claim on the counterparty. Quite dangerous. Anything with guarantees, and the word guarantee, there used to be a time when you could never use the word guarantee, but it seems to be cropping up all over the place these days. It sort of worries me rather. At the moment, ASIC either is not able or does not choose to reject products on the grounds that it thinks they're too complicated. And as Bernie Ripple said at lunch on Monday, ASIC is not a prudential regulator, and that was behind my question to him, is that I think a lot of us who have been practitioners in the markets believe we need a prudential regulator, and why not give that to the new systemic regulator? I'm not saying you need to go so far as to approve every product, but I think maybe there are some certain types of products which need to be classed as having systemic implications, and they need to go through a separate clearance process. But I'm open to how it's done. I don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater and stifle innovation. But I think at the moment that's a gap that is potentially dangerous. So anyway, that's the bulk of my paper. Run through in quick order. The particular issues I'd like to, I mean, it's open to question time now, but the four issues where I feel will be fertile discussion: dynamic capital adequacy versus dynamic provisioning, and there is a subtle difference between those. I feel strongly that it's capital rather than provisioning. Provisioning is what actuaries or accountants might do through the P&L, and that's subject to accounting standards and all sorts of games, if you like. A capital adequacy I see as a simple decision where the regulator says, okay, you used to have an 8% capital requirement, it's now 9% overnight. You know, cut back your lending or whatever it might be. The second question, as I've already related to, where does the systemic regulator fit? Should it be in the central bank, APRA, or anywhere else? And I've already said I might put my hand up for APRA. Global or local, I haven't mentioned that, but it's quite important. There's a natural desire to say, wouldn't it be better if everything was sort of global and harmonised and everything, and we had this one big wonderful system with no possibility for arbitrage or gaming or anything. I've moved right away from that, and I'm now sort of my motto is now think global, act local. And in fact, going back to 1999, I actually remember saying that at the first plenary session of the 1999 conference. Graham Thompson, who was then the new head of APRA, made a presentation in which he extolled the virtues of global harmonisation of all the rules. And my question to him wasn't that dangerous? And it was just a kind of coincidence that we're in Darwin. And what would Charles Darwin have thought of this? He might have suggested that that the survival of the financial system would be better served by having some diversity in it, and harmonisation just was basically destroying that diversity, making everything the same. So if one tree fell down, every tree would fall down. there was an article by a Harvard professor in The Economist 2 or 3 weeks ago that was pretty much taking the same view, that it was dangerous to try and build one big system, because if it did fall over, everything would fall, and it was much better to have local systems which were relevant to their local communities and their local conditions. I think one big system which is looking increasingly fragile is the euro. The euro itself is under threat, because while it suits Germany and France, it doesn't suit Spain and Italy and Greece and everybody else. So anyway, that's something people might have views on. And finally, product regulation. Thanks very much. I've spoken for longer than I intended to, but over to Fred to manage the question.
Mark, are you going to stay up there and take
I'll stay here, if you like, yeah.
Questions. Yeah, that's fine. Okay, well, could you please use the microphone and state your name before you speak? Andrew?
Andrew Wakeling, thanks very much, Mike, for an excellent and thought-provoking paper, and I hope there's a way for us to follow up on what it is that you're proposing. I thoroughly agree with you on the prospect of us using control theory and systems engineering ideas. We could easily introduce that to the actuarial syllabus, as you say, and there is a lot in that. I can agree with you completely. It does seem that we and the organisations we work for are very much involved in this. We are part of blowing the bubble up. Blowing the irrational exuberance, and it is reasonable to look at us and say, what is it that we can do? I don't think we can fix the entire economic system, but I do wonder, you put product regulation, maybe we should all decide not to run CPPI systems. Maybe we should decide that we're going to develop a category which aren't guarantees. Maybe these are best endeavours. We'll try our best to do this, but it's not guaranteed. DB pensions are actually like that anyway. Maybe we should try and do that as professional standards. Just some questions related to that. Didn't we have to have a clear out sometime? What would the world have been like if we didn't have this clear out? How arrogant would investment bankers have got? Would it have become absolutely accepted that you could just borrow at low rates of interest and invest in equities? Would house prices have gone up forever? What would be the behaviours related to that? Maybe the problem was that we didn't have a crash earlier. If we're looking at it in systems terms, we might actually wonder whether this isn't a bit like forest fire management. Maybe we should have had a burnout earlier. I don't know. I know that wouldn't be a popular thing to say. What would the system be like if we got rid of bubbles and booms? I'm not sure my children are going to like your chief risk supervisor if he's going to stop them by the beachfront property that they want. They're asking me, I don't know whether there are any here, if I actually could find a distressed investment banker who's got some toys and would like to get rid of them. They're cashed up and they want to know. You're going to get in the way of that. Is being transparent such a good idea always? If overconfidence is part of the problem, maybe we should have introduced more risk earlier. It seems that the Russians not only take the punch bowl away from the party, they arbitrarily lock up a fair number of the participants. I'm not suggesting we do that. But if equities are overvalued, how about imposing an unexpected levy on all holders of equities as of last Friday? It's 10% of your assets. Just to keep people on their toes, just to make sure they realise that it is a risky world. I think your point about Darwin and globalization is a wonderful one, and we really should keep that in mind. Or might there be some danger of overreacting in current conditions? Our system has worked wonderfully. Maybe we've got unrealistic expectations of it. Throughout my life, there's been bread in the shops. Systems, when they fail, are like Zimbabwe. Our system hasn't failed. Maybe there's some danger in suggesting that it has. I'm sure we can improve our system. I'm also absolutely certain we can damage it. Don't we have to be somewhat careful?
Well, I think there are about 100 questions there. I don't propose to answer all. I think you do need a clear out from time to time. And if you go back and read the important economists of the 1930s, people like Schumpeter and Kondratieff and even Keynes and Fisher, they did look at this process of creative destruction, and they were looking at cycles of 50 years or so. I know Colin Grenfell was telling me last night he has a 39-year cycle in his, but you do get long cycles, and then the creative destruction where the old industries are wiped out and the new industries arrive. And some people were saying that was happening in 1999 with the tech boom. That was the new industry emerging, and it was going to wipe out all the old industries. Sorry, they were wrong on that one, but maybe you've got to do the destruction first, and maybe that's what we're going through, and maybe deleveraging is going to go on a long time. As Peter Bernstein said, the future is unknowable.
Back there.
Mike, Bob Stribling, again, a great paper. I've read it twice, and I think there's really great thinking that's going on in your thought process. On this issue of product regulation, for me, I struggle with the idea that a regulator would be in a position to look at a class of new products up front and be in a position to look at those, review and approve them, because most new products start out small, so they don't have a systemic implication on day one. It's just a successful small product can very rapidly blossom into something big. I imagine the subprime product in the U.S. Started off as a very small sort of low-doc type of product way back when. So I'm wondering, for me, I struggle with the regulator being required to approve that up front in certain classes. But it seems to me that it does make sense to have the systemic regulator responsible for monitoring product evolution and just like leverage, picking up those products that are becoming systemically important, and through capital impulse and regulation, basically trying to change and drive behavior. In your paper, you signaled a reticence to that particular view. It didn't warm your heart. I'm just wondering if that's still where your heart is at, or whether...
I'm very open on it, I fully take your point, and that's a good suggestion. I think there's a lot of water to go under the bridge before we get to any practical implementation of this.
Okay, I now have a queue of three questioners, Greg first, Jennifer and Tom Carpet. So if we could keep it neat, and Brent.
I'll make it really punchy. Greg Martin, just a real couple of things. I think I agree with that last point around product regulation. I think if you actually control the rest of the system, then the product, you know, the more things change, the more they're the same. We're just packaging different sorts of leverage and stuff into products. If you look after the basics, then the products should be priced right and be okay. Two things. One is, I think the word price of risk should be somewhere in the risk regulator. I know you talk around it, around volatility and everything else, but I think the value of risk is actually the key problem. When it gets too cheap, that's when things go wrong. But I think also Andrew's point's a really important one. I don't know that as a world we've actually addressed, does 1% per annum extra growth by having a freer system with 10% fallback over 50 years, is that worse than what we've actually had? And, is there actually a problem we really need to fix as much as we think that really needs to be fixed with having a totally benign world of boringness?
Yeah. Very good question. I'll pass on that.
That's right.
I just briefly wanted to talk about dynamic capital adequacy. We've heard a lot about how it needs to be introduced, and I wanted to mention that here in Australia we actually do have dynamic capital adequacy for the life insurance industry, and I think it's served us very well. It's not hugely dynamic, and it's based on dividend yields, interest rate yields, property yields, but it does give a real level of dynamicness, which we've seen in the last 12 months, and has made a big difference to how the life insurance industry is regulated. So I think the Institute of Actuaries and the actuarial profession should actually be taking credit for that and telling people how it's worked.
Yeah, in the paper I do refer to that, and in fact that has been used overseas in our IAA group as an example of how you can build automatic dynamic capital adequacy into a regime. What I'm talking about is an extra discretionary thing, because I think you need to make something effective, you need an element of surprise to keep the market players on their toes. And so I'm looking at something on top of that. But your point's well made.
Tom Karp. Mike, as you know, I agree with most of what you've said before. We've discussed it. Yeah. 2 points I wanted to make. One is the same point that I think that has been made by a couple of speakers, and that is I think the product regulation method that you're suggesting is just impractical. I think it's better to handle it via capital impulse and so on, rather than actually approving products per se. The other one that I wanted to just put on the table is, to me, a lot of this whole problem comes down to something which was encapsulated when I first became a regulator. And one of the CEOs of the life companies, and this was back in the mid-90s, said to me, well, you know, solvency is a relative thing. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, if I look like I'm insolvent and everyone looks like they're solvent, then yes, I'm insolvent. But if I look like I'm insolvent and everyone else looks like insolvent, I'm not insolvent. It's someone else's problem. And that, to me, is part of this issue. And that's why I think it is very appropriate that you have something like a systemic regulator who basically has the responsibility to change the rules and say, you are all going down the wrong track, therefore the rules have to be changed. And forget about whether you're just better than that guy. You have to think about whether you are truly solvent or not in this current environment.
Yep. That's very well, that point very well made. I think Bernanke, a year or two ago, in a speech, emphasised the macro regulator would be looking at quite different things from the micro regulator, and the micro regulator is worrying about the firm relatively to the other firms, and the macro regulator is looking at all of them together, just as you said.
Yeah, if there's time, by the way, I think we might get the bell in a minute. But Brent, if you could,
thanks. Relatively short. Mike, as usual, you're thinking well ahead of the rest of the world, I think, and it's great. About 44 years ago, I took a woman for a walk around Keogh Bay in Wellington and asked her whether I could marry her daughter. And her reply astounded me. She said, "You make the bed, you lie on it." And I thought, I've thought about that many, many times since, and I realised that if she'd been an actuary, she would have said, look, marrying my daughter is a very risky sort of thing to do, and if you want to take that risk, that's fine, but don't think you're going to pass the risk back to me because I won't accept it, and don't think you're going to pass it on to anybody else because I won't allow it. I mean, that's what she was really telling me. So the question is, when credit risk is created, should the credit originator keep part of the risk, or all of it, or some of it?
Well, a simple answer is yes, that would be good practice. Whether it's possible to legislate that, I'm not sure, but as a principle, I would say it's an excellent one. And certainly in the insurance industry, that's the principle is that the originator normally keeps part of the risk, so makes sense.
Alex Stepman, I don't think I can top that story. Thanks, Brent. Mike, thank you for a very good paper. I've only read part way through it, but I'm now very keen to go and read the whole way through it, and might even do it twice like one of the other readers. On product regulation, just a very quick point. I had two experiences in my career where a company was introducing something new and unusual. In one case, our response was driven by our management. In the other case, it was driven by the regulator. But what was driving the product thought from an external view, if you think of it from the actuarial and marketing department point of view, was those bodies saying to us, do we actually understand what we're doing in this product? So most of the product development effort, from my part anyway, went into the work of trying to understand what we were doing so we could communicate that to our governing bodies as they variously were. And it seems to me that's probably the biggest point that a product regulator could put on to people is, yep. Do you understand enough of what you're doing, and yep. can you make it transparent enough for the others who are then going to pick up your product to understand yep. what's doing, rather than get down to the micro of approving and not approving?
Yeah, I fully support that. I mean, what a number of the products we've seen, I used to be a derivative specialist. I used to run all sorts of structured vehicles, and yet some of the retail products that came out in 2007, I could not understand how they were supposed to work. I would read a 76-page PDS and say, I don't understand what you're doing, guys. Now, if I can't understand it, how many people who were buying into the product would? The fact is, they wouldn't. They'd be... They didn't know what they were doing, and they didn't know what the cost was going to be. So, anyway, but a regulator could well interrogate the product provider and say, have you really road tested this properly?
Okay, I think we've got time for one quick last one. John Trowbridge, your hand up first there.
John's going to accept the job of systemic regulator.
Mike, I wanted to congratulate you. I think it's a fantastic paper, very, very thought-provoking. And I thought I'd just make a couple of comments on it as you've got on the board. Firstly, following on from what Tom said, when it comes to product regulation, APRA already does a certain amount of that, because if banks are wanting to include guarantees, or life companies or general insurance companies are wanting to do new things, then we are interested in them from a capital point of view. And if it's a yep. product that they don't already have, then of course they have to come to us to talk about the capital side. So there is, in effect, a level. It's not explicit in the way that ASIC might do it, but it is related to the prudential issues. On your third question, global or local, whatever the merits of the debate might be, I just don't see global regulation occurring. The politicians say it quite yep. a bit, but when it gets down to detail, I don't think individual sovereign nations are going to give up yeah. what they do. So I think whichever side of the argument you want, we're going to have yeah. local regulation. There's a degree of cooperation going on now mm-hmm. that's unprecedented, but that doesn't mean uniformity or complete harmonisation, and it doesn't mean ceding your rights to somebody in another mm-hmm. country. On the question of systemic regulation, well, I won't comment on it other than to say, well, I'll say make two points. One is that APRA does take an interest in this, and I think mm-hmm. you've put some pretty interesting questions on the table. But think about this aspect. We've got the Twin Peaks model in Australia, that is ASIC's the market conduct regulator, APRA's the prudential regulator. I think that's a very, very good system. But the issue you raise actually relates in part to those parts of the financial system that are outside APRA's purview, mm-hmm. because we only regulate ADIs and insurance companies. Yep. And there's a good philosophy, there's a substantial philosophy around that, and it's a matter for the government to decide what kind of regulation it might wish to have for those parts of the financial system that are outside APRA's purview and currently under what you might call a much lower level of supervision and regulation mm-hmm. relative to what APRA does, that is with ASIC.
Yep.
So I just wanted to make those comments, and again, congratulations on the very thought-provoking paper, Mike.
Thanks, John. Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, my assumption was that the systemic regulator would have the power over all those other institutions, and without that power, it's not going to. It's just providing an escape valve for all the products to go unregulated. So it's very important. I mean, the other important player, of course, is Treasury. And when you talk about the government taking a decision, I think Treasury has quite a strong role to play in that. While at the moment the systemic regulator might be thought of as a central bank, primarily a central bank role, I think Treasury might also think that systemic regulation is its role as well. So I think there might be a certain amount of jousting, if you like, for position taking anyway. All right, that's, thanks.
Well, yes, I think it's actually much more than 5 minutes since the first bell went. The second bell hasn't sounded, and the door is open.
Well, we've been wasting coffee time.
But I think we are now. I think we are now wasting coffee time. I must say that I think chaired many of these sessions over the years. The quality of the discussion is directly proportional to the quality of the paper, and I think in this case we've all benefited enormously from the efforts that Mike's put in to produce this paper and the thinking he's put into it. So I will present Mike with his reward, and please would you thank him in the usual way.